Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer Fails William.
That is so technically stupid.
We got a great show in store for you as we are reviewing a film that debuted last month. But we got a chance to check it out, and it was such an impressive movie that we thought about discussing it here on the Filmlosopher. So we are going to be talking about The Last Black Man in San Francisco. So stick around as we discuss that. But before we do, Spence, give them then opening credits.
Looking for your place in the world? You can always be sure that the Filmlosophers podcast will always be brought to you by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios.
That's right.
You don't have to have your head to the bay to see something new. Each Wednesday morning, head over and download the latest episode of your from your favorite streaming platform, such as Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn,
Player so FM, well.
And Audio Boom. You know, I've had a really rough week. It's been a long week.
Whatever. You know? Sounds like an excuse to me.
Don't be the last man or woman to to check us out. See, now you got me all flummoxed. You got in my head. Connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Finally, if you're going to San Francisco, be sure to take a look at all of our previous episodes before you leave. We have over 168 episodes for you to check out.
That was very specific. We have over 168.
Yes, that math checks out.
Well, I sure hope. Head over to thefilmlosophers.com where you can check out all of our episodes. We've got a great slew of episodes, including last week's episode where we talked about Spider-Man Far From Home. That was lesson 168, as Spencer so aptly put.
Yeah.
168.
Yes.
But we are talking about lesson 169, and that is The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Now, I know this sounds kind of like a goof movie or even something that wouldn't make sense. Honestly, it didn't. If you haven't heard of it, it's okay. It was released in 155 theaters nationwide. Mm-hmm. It didn't go over to, you know, worldwide. But nevertheless, it was still such an impressive movie and so pertinent to the culture of California, mm-hmm. which is where we are. Recording up here in Northern California, that we felt the need to watch it. It was kind of along the same vein as, you know, Lady Bird or Blindspotting. Being able to watch a film and know how much it resonates with not just the era that we're in, but even in the culture and the environment that we're in. So before we continue forward talking about the movie, Spence, give him that official synopsis goodness, would you?
Jimmy Fails dreams of reclaiming the Victorian home his grandfather built in the heart of San Francisco. Joined on his quest by his best friend Mont, Jimmy searches for belonging in a rapidly changing city that seems to have left them behind. As he struggles to reconnect with his family and reconstruct the community he longs for, his hope blinds him to the reality of his situation.
Directed and produced by Joe Talbot, and from a screenplay. Oh no, not from a screenplay, but
what?
No, sorry, it wasn't by a screenplay by anyone else. But directed and produced by Joe Talbot, the film stars Jimmy Fails, actually the actor in the film, who's known as Jimmy Fails. His real name is Jimmy Fails, just so you know. Jonathan Majors, Danny Glover, Tichina Arnold, Rob Morgan, Mike Epps, Finn Wittrock, and Thora Birch. The film had its world premiere at the Sundance Film Festival on January 26th of this year, where it won awards for Best Directing and a special jury prize for creative collaboration. Little tidbit about the film. Director Talbot and Jimmy Fails grew up together in San Francisco and first discussed the possibility of making this movie when they were teenagers. So that's actually really cool.
That's pretty cool.
There is no information on the production budget of the film, but domestic openings, so its domestic first weekend open, which was on June 7th, brought in $235,272. The domestic totals as of today are in the area of $2 million. Mm. So considering the fact that it was on a limited release, only in 155 theaters, this film didn't do too bad.
Yeah, and we only had like two theaters to really choose from in our area.
Yeah, so much so. Like, there was barely any of them. We were lucky to find one, and then it apparently got extended because we thought that the film had ended its, you know, the film had ended its run at that particular theater, and then we found out, oh, there's more showings. So we could have gone at a different time, but sure, it's okay.
Not bitter about that at all.
Not at all. Okay. But needless to say, like we said, this particular movie is one of those particular ones that obviously made waves at Sundance.
Mm-hmm. Since like in the trailer, it's just bam, bam, bam. We did all these things at Sundance.
Yeah, yeah. Which makes sense. I mean, they're awards. They got accolades. Why not showcase those?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Flaunt them if you got them.
Well, sure. No, I'm just kidding. But this movie is so unique because this isn't like any other independent film that we've seen thus far. It would be one thing to say, like, okay, well, this movie is, you know, oh, it's just like any other independent film about Northern California. It's not. This film is a complete separation from what you've seen thus far. Like, we've had a lot of great movies out of the Bay Area, out of Sacramento, out of all parts in the Northern California area that have come about in the last 10, almost 11 years. Going back to, you know, things like, well, even further back. I mean, if you want to go back to like to the 80s, back when movies like American Graffiti, I don't know if you've ever seen American Graffiti, but American Graffiti is a movie done by the illustrious George Lucas. And that was done actually, I'm sorry, 1973. It was filmed in Modesto, I want to say. But needless to say, it's one of those movies that you recognize when you drive through Modesto. You're like, oh, cool. Like, I've seen that place. That's in that movie, or that's, you know, whatever. And all through the years, you're seeing more and more recognition of the Northern California area with movies that have a little bit more unique impact. Going as far as with, what's his name? Michael B. Jordan and Ryan Coogler in Fruitvale Station,
yeah,
which takes place in, I believe, Oakland.
Sure.
Well, it's in the Bay. it's in the Bay Area. And then you have a return to form with more of the changes that are happening and the social change, and as well as the economic change in the Bay Area with Blindspotting. Which was it last year?
Yeah, I believe so.
It was one of last year's sleeper movies. That
still
was
so good.
It was, and it's one of those movies that I still like. I still am recommending to people to go and see, because if you haven't seen it, you are completely missing out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I'm dragging one of my roommates to see it because I bought it.
Oh, yeah, I bought it as soon as it came out.
Yeah.
I bought the digital copy, which, by the way, Lesson 126 is Blindspotting.
Yeah, so. I'm not really, you know, I must own this movie on day one, but Blindspotting was definitely one of them. And actually, so is The Last Black Man in San Francisco. I already pre-ordered that one, too.
Wait, what?
I pre-ordered this movie, the one we're talking about. Did? Yeah.
Oh, snap. I didn't even know it was available. Which, by the way, just a side note. Lesson 99, we do discuss Ryan Coogler's unique perspective when he did Fruitvale Station, mm-hmm. As well as his look and feel when he was getting ready to do Black Panther. And then you had movies like Lady Bird. Lady Bird began to stretch out into more of the experience of living in Northern California. We hold Lady Bird in a special place in our heart because of the fact that Greta Gerwig is from Sacramento, as well as the film taking place in Sacramento. So that's one of those unique things that it showcases. It would be one thing if it was just shot on location, but it's more so than just that. It's actually about Sacramento. It's kind of a love letter, if you will, to the city, which if you haven't listened to that, that is lesson 102. For all those playing at home, just to catch you up, lesson 99, Ryan Coogler one, lesson 102, Lady Bird, and so forth. And lesson 126, Blind Spotting. So we've dropped three of them so far. What do you think about that, Mr. Dali Mustafa? Sorry. Oh. So coming back to the topic at hand, getting a chance to see this movie, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, one of the unique things that I have to admit is I had no expectations for this movie at all. I may have seen like bits and pieces of a trailer, but here's the thing, and I'm going to be completely honest. The way summers usually go and the way you get movie drops, you don't necessarily have movies like this on your radar. Not to say that it's not worth watching. That's not what I'm saying at all. But with movies like Endgame and Spider-Man and, you know, everything that was dropping thus far as of late, you know, it was difficult to kind of keep track of everything that was even in the independent circuit. Now, mind you, I did hear about this film winning awards back when they started announcing the winners from Sundance way back in February, late January, early February. I had people who were there on site and were talking about it and whatnot. So needless to say, it was definitely on my radar, but then with everything else coming about, it was difficult to keep track, you know?
Yeah.
So I didn't know what to expect with this particular movie because of the fact that I hadn't seen trailers. I didn't listen ahead to soundtracks. I honestly don't remember, or I'm not too sure of any other movie any of these actors have been in, aside from obviously Danny Glover.
Yeah.
I've seen him in other things, but like the actor Jonathan Majors, the only thing I remember him in, and because it's so recent, was because Captive State. He played the older
Captain State.
He was the older brother who got lost. He was the freedom fighter, if you will, of that particular. I love how you're cringing right now. It is so great.
I did not like that movie.
Why not?
Captive State? It was a movie that could have just been a television episode of like Beyond Belief, Truth or Fiction or something.
Which, by the way, if you want our thoughts on that one, that was lesson 154. We actually talked about Captive State. So,
yeah.
But Jonathan Majors, I've only seen him in that. I don't really know how far like into his filmography I can actually remember. Tashina Arnold, swear to God, I hope I'm saying her name right. But she was in Martin. She was in Everybody Hates Chris. Mm-hmm. She was in a lot of different things. And her filmography, you know, spans pretty far and wide, which is good because I remember seeing her. But aside from that, like Mike Epps, yeah, seen him here and there. Finn Wittrock, I've seen him in other movies, but he didn't have I wasn't too sure of his role in this particular movie, so who knows? So needless to say, like this movie was not on my radar, and I feel bad for it. But it's true. I just didn't know. Like, but on the other hand, you, however, had this movie in your sights.
Now that you've said that it wasn't on your radar, I'm like, how the heck did it get in my radar?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
I don't even remember now. I just remember something pushed me to the trailer of it. And I saw that and I was like, oh, just based on this, I was like, I got to see this movie.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that's really like that's it.
Like I just had to see this movie. Sorry, that was it.
I think it's probably from seeing films like Lady Bird because, like, I didn't think I was gonna end up liking Lady Bird as much as I did.
Uh-huh.
And that kind of made me just open up to a whole other type of movie that I was never really interested in before, because Lady Bird was pretty fantastic. And
yeah.
I was hoping that this would be...
Surprisingly, too.
Yeah. I was hoping this would be its own type of fantastic. And so that's kind of what I was really hoping for going into this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. Like... And this kind of pains me to say it, but last year, one of the things that we talked about on this show was we needed to, and I think it may have been last December, I think we talked about like some of the expectations for the new year. And one of the expectations I had for myself was to be more aware of independent films that come up. And this one completely slipped under my radar. Like I didn't, whoever was doing the ad targeting for, for this film knew exactly who to target. Cause like I, as soon as they started pushing for promotion for this film, then I started seeing it, but I didn't actually get a chance to click on the trailers. But I had heard about it. Like, you hear in the circles that we're in, oh, you know, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, that's going to be one of those good ones. You got to watch out for when it comes out and blah, blah, blah. And mind you, like I said, at one point in time, the intention was to watch this movie. But, you know, it just, it slipped. And, you know, as much as I feel bad about it, it's still one of those things where it's like, I'm still glad we got a chance to see it, you know, so. But diving into this movie, and mind you, yes, there's going to be spoilers in this review, but check it out still, nevertheless. There's nothing that, you know, you're going to hear in this movie. We're not going to give away too much, but the gist of the storyline overall, the little things that matter most in this film, we'll keep those, you know, out of the review. But in terms of everything else, we'll discuss and disclose. Yeah, you think that's good?
Yeah, I think that's good. Let's get started.
Let's get into it. So the film kind of starts, interestingly enough, as this, it almost looks like a wasteland, the way the film, the way the camera is portraying it, as these individuals in hazmat suits are like clearing up the stuff from this, I don't know, from what looks like this toxic place near a bay, and you pull out and come to find like there was this little girl who is standing right there looking at him. And I think one of the things that this kind of solidifies is how much has changed within San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause the reason why I speak to this particular scene is this, it's a pretty powerful scene right from the get go. Like you have this individual who is in this hazmat suit, who is essentially from the government, standing there picking up stuff from the floor while this little African-American girl is in a beautiful dress getting ready to go to probably school, and she's watching him, and she just starts skipping. And as she's skipping, you're seeing all these other individuals in hazmat suits. And while that's happening, you have this, you know, street corner preacher who's talking about like, you know, why are these people in hazmat suits? Why are they, you know, what do they know that we don't know? And I think it's an interesting, way to portray the fact that, I mean, if you take a look at things like Flint, Michigan, is it Flint, Michigan or Flint, Missouri?
No, Michigan.
It is Flint, Michigan. Yeah. Like in Flint, Michigan, like the, with the whole thing with the water situation and how for the longest, like even still, there is yet anything to be done about that. Yeah. And there are just people who go in, they do cleanups or they do whatever, but nothing has been done about the water. And there's a lot of, sad to say, but there's a lot of, you know, diverse families that are low income families there that can't afford to leave. And all they can do is just stay in their homes or look outside and watch these individuals who have to wear like hazmat suits or special things like that just to go in the area and do cleanups. It's scary. And it makes you wonder, like, wow. You know, people have to see that on the silver screen now to kind of let it hit home. But I speak to that scene to say that this film as an entire, in its whole, does a really great job of expressing the changes and like almost, I want to say, the gentrification of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about it at length in Blindspotting in that episode about how that movie speaks directly to like, and even talks about it. Like it's a slap in the face in terms of how much they talk about it. about the gentrification of Oakland. This here is a little bit more of a subtle approach to recognizing the gentrification of San Francisco. And it's pieced beautifully in the whole of the story rather than it just being one facet of the overall thing. What do you think about that?
Well, first off, I think it's stupid that we haven't done anything about Flint's water situation. Mm-hmm. But I actually thought just the opening to this movie was just a really good primer for this is what you're in for, folks. Of, you know, just juxtaposing, like, two positions of, like, people who have slash know something versus people who don't know something or don't have something.
Or are just left in the dark altogether.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that they don't want to know. It's that nobody is divulging.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting how the separation is recognized. Like, it is in the beginning of the film, you have these two individuals, which is Jimmy Fails and you have Mont, or short for Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
And you have them trying to make this trek to Midtown San Francisco or somewhere within San Francisco proper.
Yeah.
And they ultimately decide on skateboarding there. And it is a trek. It is a journey that they have to take just to get from where they're at, just to get to San Francisco proper.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting to make that, like, recognition of, like, the amount of separation between, like, the gentrified part of San Francisco and who resides there compared to those that have lived there all their life and that are being pushed aside or bought out, you know, to mark that whole gentrification kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, the movie spends, like, a good, like, part of its opening just even just showcasing, like, how, like, some of the houses on the same street, like, are run down and just ragged looking, and the other half of the street is very nice looking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's making the expression, but it's not hitting you over the head with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's one of the great things about this particular movie. You have great performances by Jimmy Fails, which is Jimmy Fails, and Montgomery, who, you know, as we stated a little bit ago, played by Jonathan Majors. These two individuals play the most opposites in terms of one is a little bit more, they're each eccentric in their own way, as Jimmy's whole purpose in his day-to-day is to make the trek all the way into San Francisco proper so that he can pine after the Victorian home that he grew up in, that was sold back in the early 90s and has been in different hands and is now in this older couple's hands, you know, to have and to take care of. So he actually goes, and as he's pining after the house, he also notices all the things that need to get taken care of. And so he'll go and take paint, or he'll go and he will personally do touch-ups to the house. Even to the surprise of the homeowners, which the wife of the couple
is having none of this.
She's having none of this. She's like, what are you doing? Get off of our, what are you doing? I'm going to call the cops. And the husband's like, no, she's not going to call the cops. We appreciate it. It's okay. But no, we need you to get down. No more to the, so it's really, really interesting how that story kind of unfolds. With the reasoning, you find out the reasoning as to why he's making those treks down there.
So, yeah.
And then Montgomery is kind of this individual who doesn't really have friends because he's so eccentric and he's a playwright and he lives with his father, that he's just not welcomed within the dynamic of the group that's there or anybody. So it's very interesting to see how he interacts with Jimmy as well as the other, like, other individuals living in that area. Like, there's a couple of black guys who stand out front of his house, who just, all they do is just talk. They just talk about things and gossip, and they act like they're thugs or whatever, but, you know, they're not really. So
yeah,
it's very interesting.
Yeah, I probably identify more with Mont than I'd like to.
Wow.
Because, like, I don't know. I had, like, my own, like, awkward phase. And he just seems to not have a phase, but a whole awkward life. So.
Well, yeah. And it's true.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that, which, now that I'm thinking about it, yeah. It's one of those ones that kind of, Mont is one of those types of individuals that I also kind of resonate with in terms of just not really understanding certain cultures, especially the culture that you're, you know, supposed to be, you know, emulating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, take for instance, like myself, I am Hispanic,
mm-hmm.
I am Puerto Rican, and a lot of my family is also Puerto Rican, Hispanic, so forth. And so the emulation of what is normal in culture is vastly different than how I normally am. So it's fun. It's not fun. It's interesting.
Yes.
It's interesting to go to events and whatnot, and people are talking about, like, either lowriders, or they're talking about dogs, or they're talking about, you know, Mexican songs that are sung back in Mexico, or things like that, or drinking, or doing whatever it may be.
Mm.
And I'm like, I got a new booster pack from the latest Magic the Gathering set.
Oh, my gosh, this is my life, too.
You guys want to see my new planeswalker I got for... Like, that's genuinely, like, how it feels. Like, there's a wall there.
Yeah, and it feels like you're an outsider sometimes, a little bit, to your own community. Like, yeah. Is what I'm hearing. Because, like, I get that a lot, too. Because, like, I feel like that's why Mont resonates with me, is because he's kind of an outsider on his own community looking in. And I'm kind of that, too.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't say.
Okay. Thanks, Ed.
No, it's true. And it's interesting to see it being portrayed on film, and to kind of be like, is it weird that I wish I was best friends with a fictitious character in a film? Because it makes perfect sense. It's really crazy. But as you see, like, Montgomery's life, and you see how he's been exposed to certain things, like there's instances where Montgomery is sitting with I believe it's his grandfather, it's not his father. Danny Glover plays his grandfather, where he's sitting with his grandfather, who happens to be played by Danny Glover. He's a blind person in the film, and they're watching movies, and Montgomery is, like, explaining certain situations of key films that they're watching. And it's like you can see the passion that Montgomery has for exceptional storytelling by the way how he explains the film to his grandfather. And it's like recognizing, like, okay, he recognizes that because of the fact that that's how he was brought up. And it's like, oh, yeah, I can resonate with that, because that's, you know, how I was brought up, you know, talking about movies and whatnot. Oddly enough, because it's funny, like, I had a family member the other day, and so I know a lot about movies.
Yeah.
Or at least well enough.
I would hope so, since you're on a film podcast.
Hey, you can't. Never mind, you're right. No, but, like, it's weird, like, talking about, like, certain things with family, and I had a family member who asked, like, hey, I heard that they made is it true that they made a Beetlejuice 2? And I'm like, no, that's not true. And I have another cousin who just, God bless her soul, she's like, no, they did. You need to believe me, because they did. I saw the trailer online, and it was this and that. And I'm like,
what?
No, that wasn't real. That's not, no. She's like, no, it is real. I know they made it. It's probably just a fan film, whatever. I'm like,
that's... not a real film. Like, it's not.
But like, the frustration I would feel of, like, being in... Like, the frustration I kind of felt, like, being like, no, you're telling them bad stuff. Just stop. Like, you can see how, I don't know if there's like a learning difference or even a type of like adjustment that Montgomery has within being in those public settings, but there's a distinct difference between him and everybody else in that area.
Yeah.
So, and mind you, Jimmy's just as interesting. His whole recognition of the house that they keep visiting, which is an old Victorian in the Tenderloin District, if you're unfamiliar with that particular area. Jimmy keeps visiting this house that, like I said, he once was owned by his grandfather, which he quotes as saying that his grandfather built the house and that his grandfather was the first black man in San Francisco. Because during the time, as the way the film puts it, during the time after the war, when the government took all of the Asian individuals, the Japanese individuals, whomever, and they forced them to live elsewhere, Jimmy's grandfather came into San Francisco and built his own house and became one of the first black people to reside within San Francisco at that time. So he holds the moniker that his grandfather was, quote, the first black man in San Francisco. From there moving forward, like, essentially the film kind of jumps into this unique plot of how people come and go with houses, and this house actually ends up getting, I guess, foreclosed on, or it gets like,
yeah, something.
Somebody dies or something, or
wait, who are we talking about? Are we talking about in the 90s or now?
Oh, we're talking about now.
Oh, okay.
Like with the house. Obviously, the grandfather lost a house in the early 90s, so it's changed hands a lot through different buyers and whatnot. But with the current couple who was living there, the one the wife is like, I'm gonna call the cops. And
yeah, it made it seem like what was it? The wife's mom or something, like, died. Someone who she was related to died, and that person was the actual property owner, and they got kicked out of the house because of it.
Yeah. And so because of all that, it becomes empty. And when it gets empty, Jimmy, because of the fact that his father was a squatter at times, his father doesn't have a really good relationship with his son, Jimmy decides to try to break into the house and squat in the house and make it his own, thinking that he can try to figure out a way to own the house himself. So it turns into this huge journey of Jimmy trying to go back, quote unquote, home, and having Montgomery with him, having Mont with him, and Mont kind of viewing everything from the eyes of a playwright. And it kind of turns into this beautiful story of recognizing like how so much has changed in the world, and if you blink for 1 second, you're gonna miss the next change that's happening, because that's how quickly things move, not just in San Francisco, but all over the world, all over the United States, really.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
But that's one of the things that you have to admire about Joe Talbot's ability. Like, this is actually, I don't know if you guys know this, but this is actually Joe Talbot, the director. This is his directorial debut. He's actually a fifth generation San Franciscan who's lived there all his life. So recognizing a film that somebody who has lived there can throw out and show people, like, this is what life is like. This is what, you know, the changes I see in this area. And it's actually a really well-placed, well put film. Like, what do you think
about
the director being from San Francisco?
I was trying to look into him a little bit, but apparently he didn't even go to film school, from what heard about this guy.
Wow.
Because, like,
is it weird to like him more now?
Sheesh. No, like, because from the things I heard, I'm not fully sure on how accurate they are. But it seems like this guy is really good for having, like, only two films under his belt.
Well, one of them is a short film, and then the other one is this film.
Yeah, okay. I didn't realize that other one was a short film.
Yeah, the other one's a short film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... Yeah, like, interestingly enough, Joe Talbot comes from a comes from a long line of individuals who love their city. Like even his father, wrote a national bestseller back in 2013 called Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. I mean, hey, you know, it's listed as
That title's a journey right there.
It really is. It's a gripping story of the strife and tragedy that led to San Francisco's ultimate rebirth and triumph. So, I mean, Season of the Witch. That's what it's called.
I'm sure it's one of those things where it makes sense when you read it.
I mean, he also wrote a book called Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years. So who knows? I mean, hey, this guy's all over the place. I give him that.
Yeah.
But like, one of the unique things about this particular movie is recognizing the way this film unfolds. You can tell without a doubt how much not only the filmmaker, but anybody on this particular project, how much they love the town of San Francisco.
Yeah. Like the city. Know who, like, their cinematography in this movie was just off the charts.
It really was.
Because like when you can get me to notice cinematography, that's how you know that you've done a fantastic job. They had just such excellent like sweeping shots, or just shots that would just give you a lot to look at.
Yeah.
So different from the Marvel movies, like the one we saw last week.
Yeah, Spider-Man Far From Home, less than 168.
Not that it was bad or anything, but it doesn't have views like this movie does.
Yeah. And it's interesting because this particular movie holds a very unique dynamic where you think of San Francisco and immediately you go to like classic San Francisco, like streetcars, and you go to like views of the Golden Gate Bridge at magic hour and things like that. Like you think of that, and mind you, maybe some of the aesthetics and the cinematography that didn't really reflect a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the music in this film,
really good.
Like, really made you feel like classic San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Like I really did feel for every time any of the, and when we're not just talking about like the music, like song music, like the composition was phenomenal in this movie. And I've never really, I was, in all honesty, I actually thought for a second, I'm like, man, this sounds like one of those types of movies that would play like on a Saturday morning, like after the Saturday morning.
Oh, after the cartoons?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I can see that.
Like it felt classical. Like it felt like in the like mid 70s, a proper, not like an era piece, but like a proper novel adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful. You know, you got a lot of that going through it. Plus the song that you heard earlier when we were talking about the synopsis and so forth, that song is prominent as well in this film. And it makes a lot of sense. Like it, you know, if you're going to San Francisco, don't forget to wear flowers in your hair. Like you get a lot of the heart behind what makes it, why it makes it such an important thing to go to San Francisco as a certain way. Like it's a beautifully well composed soundtrack for the film itself. And which thankfully enough, I have Apple Music. So I just made sure I had the soundtrack on my phone and start listening to that. But it's incredible. And this story kind of falls into this, you know, stampeding storyline of maintaining a house that doesn't belong to you, with, you know, everything that's changing in the world and everything that's changing in San Francisco, and how, you know, like I said, in the blink of an eye, things can change and people can go, or, you know, life changes. Like it's interesting how a lot of what makes up the home for Jimmy reflected or kind of paralleled a lot of the changes that were happening in San Francisco. You know?
Well, what do you mean?
Like you had changes that were happening. You had Jimmy focusing so much on the different things that were happening with his home.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like every time a setback would happen, or anytime anything substantial would happen in the home, it would kind of push Jimmy a little back or kind of set him back a little bit. But similarly with things that were happening, like whether somebody died or things were happening, like experiences with his dad or whatever, it did the same thing to him. And it was like the house mirrored what life was like, what home as the city meant to Jimmy. And it almost kind of shows like Jimmy's home had always been San Francisco. It wasn't so much a building, but it was the city, you know, and it was very interesting seeing how a lot of it was being expressed and how a lot of it was being, you know, built upon. You have, and like I said, I don't want to go into too many details because then it gives away a lot of the great storytelling that you have in this film. Mm-hmm. But I mean, oh my gosh, there's a scene in the film that kind of, I don't want to put it on the same level because it's not, but it's similar in nature as to the climactic scene in Blindspotting, where you have in Blindspotting this explosive moment where this character who has been emotionally charged for the last 2 days in the film comes to the point where he emotionally and verbally explodes in this tirade of poetry and, you know, emotion, that it's beautiful because of the way it's delivered. In this movie, there's a scene where there's a play that is happening that just explodes in this tirade of emotion and revelation to everybody that is in the room, not just to any one particular character too. And it's almost, I mean, I don't want to have to make the draw the comparison, but it's very similar to like a preacher, you know, speaking on something straight truth or whatever. Like this guy was hitting on the points that he was making were just profound and unique, that it was speaking to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was just as explosive in the film, you know. But like I said, it wasn't, I still liked Blindspotting a lot more in terms of that scene for many different dynamics, but this film has that kind of heart to it just as well, like the revelatory statements that he was making in that instance still held a lot of weight to it.
Yeah, it's very hard to beat someone when one movie has a person rapping all of their their very emotional lyrics. That's a high bar to jump.
I wasn't okay.
I know they're not. I know you're not trying to do one for one comparison.
Yeah,
I'm just like
no. But this particular movie, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, it's not so much a movie about a man's journey to find his home. It's more of a man's recognition that he's always been home.
Ooh, that's a good tagline right there. They should take that.
it resonates on a much more strong on a strong level of like, you know, a place shouldn't register as just the only place that feels like home, because it kind of gets, you know, well impacted at one of the very last scenes. You know, when he's sitting on a bus and there's a woman, there's these two, you know, ladies that are sitting over by, and she's like, oh, I've been in this city already for a while, and I think I hate it and whatever, blah, blah, blah. And one of them's like off put by his name. It's like, I think I can hate whatever I want. He's like, do you love it? And she's like, what? And he's like, do you love San Francisco? She's like, I don't know. He's like, well, he's like, then you can't hate it. You can't hate something you don't love. And it resonates with her in a way where she realizes, I think I do. I don't know if I do love the city. So does that give me the right to hate it? Or I think I do love the city. Why do I love it? Should I actually still hate it? You know, it becomes this like mind twist. It's a twist.
Except, like, I think I kind of get what he's going for, because like I kind of in this weird way feel the same about Sacramento.
Oh, 100%.
Like, because like I hate this town, but I love it.
Okay.
Like, it does, so many things stupidly, but it's also like the place where all my friends are is where my home is. Yep. So like I love it, but I hate it.
No,
and but I love it. But I hate it.
Wow, we're getting into the weeds with Spencer.
You're getting into some deep psychological issues. <now. laughs>
But that's the thing. That's the kind of mindset this film leaves you
yes,
with.
Yes, it is.
You are on this emotional and mental journey along with the main character to recognize, like, what is home? What does home mean? This individual had experienced, you know, finding what he thought was home, tried to make it his own, invited people he loved into it, invited everybody that was willing to come into it, and it still never was home to him. Like, one of the unique things about the movie is that you never really finish... One of the unique little epiphanies that I had is you never really see him finish working on it.
Hmm.
So, home was never right until he was done. And he was never done. So, was it home then? Because I believe there's a scene where he's like, you know, that feeling where it's home. It's, you know, that's that feeling that I miss. Like, it just feels like home. I don't know if home should constantly be worked on like that for it to be right. And he was always trying to make it or work on it somehow. Yeah. So it was just, there's, like I said, there's a lot of revelatory moments and epiphanies that you have in this movie. And it's a very interesting movie because it doesn't have like a lot of ups and downs in this movie. Like, there's not a lot of, you know, high points and low points. The film kind of just continually progresses into this, you know, gradual incline of information and story structure.
Yeah.
Until it gets to like the third act of the film, and that thrusts the movie into this overdrive of like, okay, now we're getting into some stuff where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. You're on that final lap, and they just told you that we cut the time in half that you had to finish the goal, so you're really putting it into gear. Not that it feels rushed. It feels perfect. It's just that everything gets amped up in that third act, and you find yourself like, whoa, you know? So.
Yeah, I remember just leaving the movie theater. I was like, I just feel like I got hit by a truck. But not like I was about to say, not in a bad way, but like getting hit by a truck's always bad.
I was gonna say I've never been hit by a truck that I'm like, you know, I should do that again.
Yeah, so maybe a bad analogy, but yeah, no, I feel what you're saying right now, Ed.
It's you know, it's interesting because of the fact that this movie is only in 150 somewhat theaters.
That's so sad. Because, like, this movie should be seen by way more people. I know it's not quite as mainstream as, like, you know, some other movies, but this is definitely a movie worth seeing.
It really is. And it's... I don't know. It's definitely a film that... as much as I would love to see other people, you know, fully understand it or watch it in its entirety, I don't think a lot of people would understand it like we would. It's a great film, and there's a lot to pull from it, but I think it's a very unique and special film that, I don't know, I don't think everybody would grab and everybody would understand. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, as much as I am completely in the vein of, oh, you know, this is a movie for everybody. Everybody should, you know, totally get it. You know, everybody should totally, you know, watch it and understand it and whatnot. I don't know if they would. You know?
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
And oddly enough, like, this film, the way it ends, it does end quite appropriately as, and mind you, this isn't giving anything away, but like the final scenes are the scenes of, like, at this point in the film, you know, everybody's story is kind of resolved, and you just get these last shots of the Golden Gate Bridge, and you have the water, and you have the last line from the what's that book, The Great Gatsby.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the line goes, you know, so we beat on boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. Like, we repeat ourselves. We are back, brought back to a stage, even though as much as we've progressed, we're back to where we were when we first started this race. And I think that's a great way to end, if you will, the film, kind of recognizing, like, as much as time has changed and as much as things have progressed and as much as even within the 2 hours of watching this movie, so much has happened, we still, even after all this, come back, find ourselves back at the beginning. And that's to say, like, nothing's going to change. The world is still going to be as it is. People are still going to be as they are. People, ignorant people, people who are just oblivious, if you will, to anything that happens around them. Like, I kid you not, I'm pretty sure there are people out in Flint, Michigan who are like, ain't nothing wrong with the water. Water's fine. I don't know what everybody's complaining about. And not even worried, not even thinking on it. But because they're ignorant to the larger situation as a whole.
Hmm.
Please don't write into the show and tell us, you know, oh, you're wrong, everybody. Like, I'm just saying, there may be. Just like how there are people out there who are oblivious to the shootings that are happening, you know, with, you know, unarmed individuals by the police, or the crime, you know, that is continuing to rise, and the way that other countries are being toppled over because of the government, and the people are finally fed up with it, or people who are turning a blind eye to everything that's happening, like in China right now. You know, there's so much happening, and yet I'm sure that there's also a large group of people who are just worried about who the Bachelor is going to pick next week, or, you know, who's going to make it on Paradise Island or whatever reality TV shows are on. Or
is that even on?
I don't even know. It's Fox. Who knows? Fox brings back the garbage shows and they leave, like, the best stuff on the cutting room floor. But, like, in the nature of humanity itself and the way the world is, you know, we will continue to fight and whatnot, but the current is just going to bring our boats right back to the beginning. And we're still going to find ourselves back there. And it's sad because of the fact that there's truth in that. That book, written many, many years ago, you know, back in God knows when, was at the time a very unique storyline. But it's true, like, we are in an age where moving forward, it, not to say that we shouldn't, but to say that because of the world around us, it makes all of our efforts, because not everybody understands that, it makes a lot of our efforts futile. Like, it makes us incapable of creating the bigger change, because there are more people out there who don't care about change than there are people who want change. And that's the sad truth. That's why more people will show up to vote for American Idol and not vote for the next senator or the next congressman or the next president, you know? And in similar fashion with this, like, you have the gentrification of San Francisco. You have people coming in and buying houses that rightfully belong to other families, or taking up area, or not talking or not communicating about the things that are happening in local sewage ways or waterways or whatnot. Like, if there is ever a place where I go that sells a three-eyed fish or a four-eyed fish, I'd be worried right away.
I wouldn't eat it.
I would not even touch it with a 10-foot pole. Like, I would be worried.
If I saw that, I'd just walk out. Like, I'm not going to deal with this.
It's the special of the day, three-eyed fish, yeah, not four.
Your special day to not shop here. What?
But it's like, it's those instances that you're like, where are those that are tired of change and need to do something about it? Like, take, for instance, Sacramento.
Mm.
there's a lot of things that need to change, and there's a lot of work that has to be done. But we don't have a lot of people who step forward and do it. Unless it directly affects them, they're not really going to move. And I speak personally because I'm the same way. I have yet to see a cause that I'm willing to jump onto or to join forces with and really, but because nothing has affected me. But that is one of the things that this movie kind of spurns the change in. You know, I recognize that. I see it. And I should do something about it. I shouldn't wait until, you know, a family member was shot because he was unarmed and he was shot by a police officer, or the water situation in the area where my older family members live and they're getting sick because of the water, or waiting for, you know, somebody I know to get discriminated against and didn't get accepted into this college or that college or whatever. Like, I shouldn't have to wait. I should already see the change and begin helping make that change possible. And it's a hard pill to swallow for anybody, but needless to say, it's still a very much pill that we all need to swallow.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's just one of those things where appropriately placed, that last line hits probably the hardest out of the entire film. So, any last thoughts before we wrap up?
I think I need to watch this movie again. You give me a lot to think about.
Well, I'm glad. I mean, we did see the same movie.
I know, but I'm I never thought about it like that.
Well, when you go see it, I'll go see it with you. How about that?
Okay.
So, wrapping this film up, let's go ahead and go across the table and go ahead and, Spence, let us know, does the film pass or fail, and how many monocles?
Yeah, this film totally passes.
I hope so.
I'm going to give it a 5 because, oh, wow. No, I was just impressed with this movie from, like, beginning to end. Like, even the trailer was shot in a way that made it me just really want to see it, and I just was not disappointed at any point with this movie. Like, from the acting to the way it was shot to just the whole direction of the film, I was just blown away.
So you're giving it a 5 monocles out of 5 is what I'm hearing.
All right.
The film does pass for me. It, as I said, it was an exceptional film that really speaks to a lot of different levels of understanding for anybody's community and anybody a part of it. If you consider yourself a part of any community, this is a movie that will definitely help you understand what your role is or what you've done thus far with that community. And are you being a great advocate to it? So it's a great movie. And I, as well, actually, I'm going to give it 5 monocles. I think this movie, unfortunately, is so underpromoted, not to anybody else's fault. Obviously, the filmmakers are doing the best they can. And it's up, really up to us. In all honesty, it's up to us to promote it and push it as much as we can and get people to see it. Because without this movie, that's a part of San Francisco. That's a part of the history of who we are and the future of what we can be that we're leaving on the cutting room floor. So we'll be the Fox of society. Fox TV, you know.
Oh, okay. I was like, what?
So... But that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Again, you can check out this episode and all our other episodes at filmlosophers.com. Also, you can check us out. Let us know your thoughts on this film. If you've seen the film, if you were one of the many who got a chance to check it out at the 150-plus theaters that it debuted in, let us know your thoughts. We want to know what you thought of the film. Did you like it? Did you not like it? What did you get out of it? Shoot, there may be something that not even I got out of it. So let us know on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. So we want to hear from you. So we're excited as the month is continuing on. We got San Diego Comic-Con right around the corner, and we got some things to debut once we head out there. So we'll be letting you know more and more about what's to come with the Filmlosophers and San Diego. This is news to even Spence.
I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. What's happening? We're taking a road
trip. I'm dragging you to San Diego. So, but thanks again for listening in. So, from all of us, well, not all of us, but from all of us here.
All of us, it's you and me.
From all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.